Hello, this is Melissa, and today is the 23rd of May, 2024, and I'm happy to be speaking with Adam in Germany again. Hello.
Hello. Good to be back, as always.
Yes, it is nice. We're about 3 hours delayed on our record because my internet went down last night, and it was one of those things that I troubleshooted everything that I could think of, and even Adam and I were having a little troubleshoot. I went to a friend's house and used their computer to contact him, and he was giving me some ideas, which I tried, no avail. But the tech company came out, and it was a weird little dangly wire thing, definitely above my pay grade, but they have fixed it.
Okay. Yeah, that was good that it got sorted so quickly, because I had thought that, you know, it could have been something more serious.
It could have been, and it's always, I mean, I was actually discussing with the techie, so, well, a lot of people are certainly dependent on their computers, and I said, well, I am amongst those people. I would, I'd happily give it up if I wasn't doing it for work, but, you know, I could think of a lot of things to do with my time and energy, but I'm totally dependent on the computer.
Yeah, but aren't we all, in a way, one way or another, yeah.
We had talked a little bit back and forth, and there were a couple of things that we wanted to make sure and cover. And if you want to start with your layovers, your stopovers to and from Germany to New Zealand, you know, via China, maybe that's where we should dive in.
Yeah, sure. I mean, just so that, everybody sort of knows what's happening. This is basically a bunch of random topics, or the leftovers from other previous episodes that we need. So there's no theme today, is what I'm trying to say. But there's a couple of stories that are kind of like, they're just random stories and things that have been on my mind that we've been batting forth for a while now, and thought, well, it'd be nice to share them. It might be fun. So the China story is, you know, that was quite interesting. So we flew to New Zealand for the Christmas New Year period for about a month. I hadn't been home since well before COVID. It was a year before COVID. I can't remember. It was four or 5 years. Mm-hmm. I've been away for a long time, hadn't seen my family. My father's been up here a couple of times, but other than that, hadn't seen my family. It was a big deal. And because of the airline tickets had gone up so much in the past few years, that we ended up having to go with a budget kind of Chinese airline through Shanghai with a big layover, because it's a long flight. It's really tough, to be honest, and I'm not getting any younger. So like a 24 to 30 hour flight without any brakes, it's just nuts. It'll make you sick. Is mm-hmm. what it will do. Mm-hmm. It'll ruin your holiday and make you sick. So we did that. We opted for the layover. To get this out now, I mean, I didn't leave the airport, but I did enter the country officially as a visitor. You know, mm-hmm. I got a temporary visa. And man, even just in the airport, you can get an idea of what it might be like living there, and the incredible, the culture, the technology. I mean, you get off the plane in Shanghai, and this is after like a 9 or 10 hour flight from Frankfurt, and you're really tired. Everybody's really tired. You get in at 6 o'clock in the morning or whatever it is, and you've got to go through. It's such an enormous airport. You're going on trains and buses and up escalators and down escalators and round, and it goes on and on and on. And unlike most international airports, usually what happens is that you go through, if you're transferring, you don't have to go through any, you normally don't have to go through any security. You just sort of go into a lounge, you wait, you jump on your next plane. Mm-hmm. They might have some basic like ticket checks or something like that, but you know, you're not entering the country. So often they don't, there's no checks, there's no scanning, there's no ID checks or anything like that. In China, it was literally one after the other. It just kept going. It was like, first it was, I can't remember, but there was facial scanning. So everybody's got to line up. You've got to line up with your passport and look into a camera and it's scanning your face, and then you've got to, the gate opens, and you've got to walk through the gate, and then put your passport on a scanner, and it scans the passport, and you think, okay, well, that's that done. It's like, no, it's just the beginning. You go to the next one, and it's like, now it's a health one. This one's doing temperature. Oh. It's checking your temperature. You've got to look into the camera, and it's doing infrared technology or whatever the hell it's doing to check that you don't have a high temperature, you know? So this is all sort of COVID era stuff, but I think it's probably been in action a bit longer than that in China, at least anyway. So you go through like two or three of these things and you think you're done with it. And then there's more. Then you go to the actual, I guess it's customs or something. Yeah. It's like the whole thing's run by military police. Basically, the people who are running the airport, they've all got face masks on and they're all wearing military jack boots and white helmets, and they've got batons and walkie-talkies, and it's looking pretty damn intimidating. Mm-hmm. On purpose.
Question, are there guns or just batons?
Within the airport, I think some have and some don't. Mm-hmm. There's different levels. Mm-hmm. There was a spot, one spot that we saw going through like a baggage scan, and I think we counted 25 security cameras at this one location. I mean, like every inch of this location was being scanned. Like there was just like it was a battery of cameras, you know? The next thing that I had to do was go into, I had to scan my passport on some other machine to get a ticket to take to a desk for them to authorize the temporary visa or whatever the hell they call it. And this machine is like a karaoke machine. It's like this pink graphics, and there's all this cutesy kind of like karaoke music playing, like typical Asian stuff, you know? And I was like, what is this? This looks like an arcade game or something. And I went up to it, and I couldn't figure out how to use it, and I pushed a button, and then it just said, keep moving or go to the desk or something. Anyway, then you wait in a queue for, I don't know, it must have been 45 minutes to an hour. Mm. And these people are deliberately going as slow as they can. They take your passport, they look at it, put it down, talk to the friends, they look at it again, put it down, they talk to the colleagues, they give the passport to the guy next to them, he looks at it, they talk about it, they look at you. And this goes on for about 5 minutes, and it's purely a delaying tactic. They're not doing anything productive. There's no rhyme or reason here. It's just, they're showing you who's boss, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. It's sending you a message. You will wait for us. Eventually what do they do? Oh, that's right. Then you've got to scan your fingers. They do a fingerprint. I think they do another face scan thing or something like that. And only then do they let you through. And so you're passed, you know, you've entered the country officially.
I mean, you're still in the airport.
Still in the airport. And once that had happened, we had already booked a hotel within the airport because we had a 16-hour stopover and we needed to sleep, basically. Mm-hmm. So the hotel was within the airport, but even just within the airport, man, the security doesn't stop. You think, well, I'm in the airport now. I've passed the border. I'm in the country. But no, there's baggage scans at all the choke points, all the bottlenecks around the airport where you've got to go somewhere, you know, between terminals or between major areas. They have these like metal detectors or security scanners or what have you. And it looks as if they're mobile. They can be sort of moved around at will. Like they're not permanent, like they can just sort of, it's like a mobile checkpoint. Anyway, we went through so many of these, and I was watching very carefully the whole time what was happening. I was looking at the people who were running them. I was looking at the body language and looking at what they were doing. And I am convinced that these things were purely for show.
Really?
They're not even scanning for anything. I think a lot of that stuff, I think a lot of that stuff in that airport was pantomime. There was theater. It's all psychological. Well, most of it, at least, anyway, you know? And you see the... Sorry, go on.
No, I was going to say that makes sense to me because I think so much of the way things are presented to us is theater.
Yeah, I'm convinced of it. The way... It, there was no rhyme or reason. They weren't even, you put your bags on the scanner. You know, when you go in the airport, you put, you've got the baggage x-ray machine thing, right?
Right.
The baggage gets, then they look at, they can get a brief look at what's inside of it. Well, they're not even looking. And it's like, I'm looking at the person who's supposedly looking at the screen, and it's like, they're not, they're on their phone, or they're looking away or talking to somebody else. And I saw this kind of behavior so many times throughout the airport that I realized that whether or not these machines were actually doing the thing that they're ostensibly doing, it was irrelevant, because the policies were not being deployed for an actual purpose other than to intimidate. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And remind everybody who's boss. And then, well, you see the impact that it's had. You see swarms of people yammering on their phones, going through these things, like jumping through these hoops like a dog's at a dog show. Like they've been trained their entire lives to accept this way of life. It's totally normal to them. They don't even bat an eyelid. You'll see people maintaining a conversation as they pass through one of these scanners, and they're not even looking at what they're doing. They're on their phones, or they're talking to the person next to them while they're taking their jacket off, and while they're putting their hands up to get scanned for bombs, you know, sort of, you know, hold your arms out to the side, this kind of thing, you know. And it's, you see this as an entire culture that has been under authoritarianism for generations. This is what it looks like, you know?
Mm-hmm. I have a question about if you were able to observe this at the airport. When you saw a group like that of mostly Chinese people, did they operate, did they act as a group, as a collective, as a mass? Did they all kind of move at the same time?
Yes. Yes, exactly. Uh-huh. Yes, that's what I mean to say. That's what I was trying to communicate there. Like, see, a swarm of fish.
I haven't done much traveling at all since I moved to Canada and back. Mm-hmm. You know, I think maybe only one flight in, say, 18 years or something like that. But I remember very clearly when I flew into Toronto to move up there.
Yeah.
And I happened to be coming into the airport with a very large group of Chinese people. And what struck me, first of all, what struck me was it was really hard for me to navigate within the group. They moved like a school of fish, and I hope this doesn't come across really awful, but I felt like I had to kind of do some things that were, I wouldn't say aggressive, but they were very pronounced and deliberate so that I could navigate my way through the group and beyond.
Yeah.
I needed to get around them, and they seemed to like move and block at the same time, and making it very difficult for me to pass through for the luggage. And I did get through, but I thought, that's just so weird. And I thought it might have been the first time that I was really in such close proximity with maybe four dozen Chinese people.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I felt that I had gotten caught up in a school of fish, and I wasn't swimming in the same direction.
No, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. There's so much, once again, you see, this is a culture that's been under communism and, well, a form of communism and definitely an authoritarian system for decades, for generations. You know, this is totally normal to them.
Mm-hmm.
Totally normal. When we were in the hotel, we were up quite high, and we had a view down on one of the major airport terminals. And I was watching, there's a policeman goose stepping along the terminal front, like a military goose step. He's got red and blue flashing lights on his jacket.
Mm.
So like police lights that you'd see on a car, but it's actually on his jacket. And he's just walking up and down this stretch of road, like the sort of the entrance way to one of the big major terminals there, Terminal 1, I think it was. Like the the guards at Buckingham Palace or something. It's 24/7. He was there the whole, he was there the whole time we were there. We stopped on the way back from New Zealand as well. We stayed in the same hotel and he was there then. So this is a 24/7 job, walking up and down, goose stepping in a military fashion with red and blue police lights on your jacket.
See, to me, you know, this brings up something that happened to me not that long ago. I was with a couple of my brothers, and we went somewhere, and we were driving home. It was about a 15-minute drive, and it was after dark. And we were on a stretch of highway there, and there was something going on where there were a couple of police cars. And I had noticed this once before being out at night, but it's like that jacket that you're describing. You know how for our whole lifetime, a police car, whether you're in Europe or America or anywhere, it's just a light on top of the vehicle. Well, right. now they've covered the cars so that they have lights pretty much all over the car at different points in the car. And the effect is this rapid movement of light, the red, blue, and the white in there. It's very distracting. And I think that the excuse that they give is so that you don't miss it on a freeway, you know, that you're aware that they're, but that's just a ridiculous excuse because whoever missed a cop car, you know what I'm saying? You can't miss them. No. And this is something, it's like a visual pollution that is so intense and so annoying. And actually one of my brothers said this, that's psychological warfare. And it is. It's the intensity of it. And that's what that jacket sounds like. It's just like, I goose step and I've got these lights that are, they'll hurt you.
Yeah, exactly. It's to jar you so that you're jarred and disorientated and impressed by it, mm-hmm. and made you feel small, basically. Mm-hmm. That was clearly what the feeling that came through, the words that came to mind when we were in China, and I remember saying this to Pauline a couple of times when we were there, is like, life is cheap. Life is cheap here. Mm. That's really the sense that you get from everything that you're saying. Country of, 1.6, 1.7 billion people. Life is cheap. Mm. Sadly. Yeah.
That's sad.
Yeah. But, as Alan would say, it didn't start yesterday.
No. So. And what I'm sure that you see this in Germany too, but what I see, Alan talked about this with the change, the obvious change, and they announced it in Canada. You'd always had the policeman wearing the light blue or the blue and khakis, the light blue and khakis, and he said they were covering this on the news, the introduction of the knee-length black boot and the black...
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I tell you what, that just reminded me, I noticed this when we were in New Zealand. I was in Auckland, the big city there. That's where I was born. And we were driving around, just doing some sightseeing around the city. And, I was looking at the police. Everything was so much more aggressive. You know, they're armed now. They never used to be armed in New Zealand because they've exported so many criminals into that country that the gang violence has gone through the roof. At least that's the story. That's the excuse, of course, But yeah, the police are carrying guns now. That's standard. And whenever I saw the police, they were putting on the lights and like slamming on the gas. I just saw the same thing over and over again was police cars driving in such a way as if you would think there was a live shooter situation or something like that. Mm-hmm. It was high alert. It was high intensity. It was high aggression. The police were they had all their arms covered in tattoos. They looked very, very, they deliberately looked as intimidating as possible. Very different to the police force that I grew up with when I was born in New Zealand. They were still wearing blue back then, would you believe? They didn't care. They weren't armed. They would have a shotgun in the back of the car as a for an emergency, but that was it. They didn't care. They were not armed when they were walking around. Yeah. And they were, there was some sense that they was part of the community, at least. So at least that was the feeling that they, yeah, there wasn't the same antagonism. But I mean, we see this in every country now. The police have been trained to look at the public as an enemy.
And
the public are the enemy. So.
You've got to see it. You know, this is with the Black Lives Matter and Antifa rioting that went on here, and there was some of that in the UK and around Europe. Yeah. But what you see is the people pitted against the police, and there's so much at play here, all very deliberate, though. There's the militarization of the police, where they've been given way too much military training and military equipment. But on the one hand, they feel they need it, and I can see it from their point of view, because they've been, each country has been flooded with immigrants, and many of them are violent gang member immigrants. This is deliberate. That's by design. And then at the same time, you've got the rioting going on several years ago. You had the whole defund the police movement. And there are some cities in the United States, and I'm sure that it's this way probably in Germany and other parts of Europe, where you really would have to think twice to be a policeman in that city. Like, if I wouldn't want to be a policeman in San Francisco or Seattle or Portland or Detroit. I mean, you know, I wouldn't want to do that. I mean, not that I'd want to be a policeman anyway, but if you know, you see what I'm saying? It's a multi-layered problem that has been deliberately created.
Oh, absolutely. And we saw this once again in New Zealand. I mean, there's always been gang problems there historically, especially with the Maori and Polynesian populations. I mean, they've been going on for generations, but it was all ramped up basically during the whole COVID thing. They brought a whole bunch of these guys who had been living in Australia back into the country. So there was some law was changed somewhere. I don't know exactly what it was, but it meant that a whole bunch of these hardened criminals in Australia had to be deported back to New Zealand, which, of course, this then upsets the delicate balance of power in gangland, you know? Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden you've got big power struggles going on and public executions, gang wars, turf wars, collateral damage, you name it. I mean, this stuff's really going on for real. Mm-hmm. It's exploded quite a bit in the last 4 or 5 years. And of course, the media has a field day with all of this stuff, because they get to push the fear and cradle the antagonism. And I mean, I don't think there's like a defund the police movement in New Zealand, but when I see that one in America, I mean, that just makes me think that this is deliberately set up to create antagonism between the general public and the police.
No. Absolutely.
And nothing more than that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's so many multiple examples of this. I mean, there was the shooting that happened in South Texas a while ago now, more than a year ago, where the police just appeared. They were given a stand down as the shooter was in the school, and you know, they did not move, they did not do anything, and you know, see, things do seem to be deliberately set up for that. Johnny was telling me the other day when I was talking to him that he had just seen something that had really made him angry. This was, it was a policeman's dash cam footage. This was a gang member, fairly notorious, who had not been properly checked at the border, had just come right on in, might have been MS-13, I'm not sure, but he was speeding or doing some kind of traffic violation. Policeman just was standing in the window there and said, "Oh, okay, no problem. Let's just get your ID here and we'll get you on your way." And the gang member just pulled out a gun and shot him. This was all captured from the policeman's dash cam camera so that you could see enough of it to understand what had happened, but he shot the policeman dead and drove off.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. So,
It is believable, unfortunately. Yeah. These things happen.
Yeah.
But horror is horrific. Yeah. As you say that, I mean, who would want to be a policeman?
No.
Yeah.
No, because...
I mean, pretty...
Because the whole thing has been, it's been set up to be militarized for this time, but also set up to have maximum antagonism between citizens and the police.
Yeah. And, you know, of course, just like any group, the police will band together even more under stress. I mean, there's a brotherhood anyway. It's they're all Masons. And that will just make that will strengthen those bonds.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
And probably make them a lot less tolerant than they might have otherwise been. Yeah, I mean, we're pretty lucky here in northern Germany where we are. But I've been to places not too far away from here that shocked me. I was in Hamburg a couple of months ago picking up some furniture, and I ended up going into one of the ghettos, not knowing that this is where I had to go. And I could not believe it. I could not believe that this is Germany.
Really?
You know? I didn't want to get out of the car.
What was it like? What was the scene?
Like fires burning on the street and parties with bonfires and yelling and graffiti and people throwing bottles out of windows and people passed out in the middle of the road from heroin or alcohol. I don't, you name it. Like imagine the worst apocalypse. Imagine like, you know, some kind of like a, Escape from L.A., post-apocalypse, blockbuster movie. You know, I was like, man, this is Germany. I couldn't believe it. I had no idea, absolutely no idea. Like real, real ghettos in the inner city of Hamburg as well. And Hamburg is a very, very wealthy city too. And that's where the Rothschilds are from,
right?
Incidentally.
Yeah, yeah. I think we've talked about that a little while back.
Yeah. Big banking city. A lot of German royalty there. A lot of German aristocracy from Hamburg. Yeah. Pretty crazy.
Well, speaking of Escape from LA and dystopian movies, shall we go to Hollywood?
Yeah, why not?
All right.
So, new chapter, new story. This was almost 10 years ago now. This was 2015. So, yeah, it's been a while, but I used to do a podcast with Aaron France from The Age of Transitions. So that's the guy that people might know the film, The Age of Transitions, about transhumanism. It was quite popular.
I think I mentioned it in something that came up. I actually mentioned a part of an interview that you had done and Aaron France too.
Yeah, he was... We just got to know each other through email and became good friends, and then we started up our own podcast together. And he was a follower of Alan's work, at least he was then, you know. And yeah, I actually, after some years of doing podcasts, I was traveling from Scotland back to New Zealand. I decided to drop make a stopper over in Los Angeles and visit him actually and stay with him for a while, which I did. I stayed there in Southern California in Orange County for a couple of weeks, and we did a lot of sightseeing and hung out a lot, and I got to see quite a bit of LA and Hollywood. Us being us, of course, we had to go and look at some of the more interesting esoteric or occult type places, you know. it was too interesting opportunity to pass up. So we went to Rand Corporation and filmed out there, their main premises there. That's kind of in the Long Beach area from memory.
Mm-hmm.
And then we drove to the Hollywood Hills. So we went up to Laurel Canyon and looked at a lot of those spots that, the author Dave McGowan did that fantastic book.
Yes.
About the hippie movement and the Laurel Canyon scene.
Yeah, that book was inside Laurel Canyon. And for people who
that's right.
want to know a little bit of music history, that is an excellent book. And what he makes a really fascinating connection there, which is so many of the people in that scene in that time in the late 60s, the musicians like Jim Morrison and who is another biggie there, but they were
Frank Zappa was the big ringleader, of course. Then you had Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, of course. They were big, heavy in that scene.
So what he does is he connects these musicians, these performers, to the military-industrial complex that many, many people that were given to us as stars in that era came from major military families.
Well, what it was that particular scene that was basically a whole bunch of artists that all just appeared on the scene in Laurel, coming out of Laurel Canyon right at the same time. Mm-hmm. And they all, the ones from Laurel Canyon, they're all coming from military and intelligence backgrounds and families.
Yeah.
Like reasonably bright, high ranking ones as well.
Yeah. Well, I did that Real History on Buffy St. Marie last year. And one of the little things that I looked up led me to, I'm completely blanking on her name, but the long blonde guitarist from Canada
Joni Mitchell.
Yes, thank you. Joni Mitchell. Yeah. See, you were, Joni Mitchell, it just said right there in the wiki, and blah, 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 blah. And then she introduced so and so to the manager, blah, blah. And then she ended up in Laurel Canyon.
Right.
Yeah.
I found it somewhat interesting and a bit of, well, I shouldn't be upset or disappointed that people like, because I like Joni Mitchell's song music, you know, the early songs, and same as Neil Young, but they ended up being big proponents of the jab, you know.
Yeah.
They were heavy, heavy promoters of that, which is just, anyway, let's not even go down that road, but. Yeah, so anyway, we had some interesting experiences driving around Laurel Canyon and looking for that CIA Lookout Mountain Observatory that's mentioned in David McGowan's book as well. You had this kind of like a CIA propaganda factory or whatever you want to call it that was based in the Laurel Canyon area at that time as well. And it was just, it just goes on and on. And I've actually got the book right in front of me right now. I would really advise people to get that book. Sadly, Dave McGowan passed away a few years ago, but it's a book worth reading. Anyway, that day, we got followed around a bit, which was weird. I think it was some security guy or something, but we were taking photos and driving through the hills and somebody was following us. But anyway, we drove back down through Bel Air and there was another location that we had been trying to track down, and that was the Hollywood's Pentagon. The Pentagon's Hollywood liaison officers. So this is the department of the United States military that deals with Hollywood and film. Pretty interesting. I think it was East, West LA. I can't remember exactly.
Is it on Hollywood Boulevard?
It's not on Hollywood Boulevard, but. You know, my memory is foggy here.
Well, there was a weird office that I used to go by, and friends would say, "Oh, that's they didn't say the Pentagon office, but they said, "Oh, that's Little Washington D.C. or something like that." And that was
It's in the Oppenheimer Building.
Ah, okay.
The building's called the Oppenheimer Building. It's a big office block.
Yes.
Okay. And it's fairly central, fairly built up area of Hollywood.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
It might be North Hollywood. Anyway, it's been a long time. I can't remember exactly where, but yeah, we.
But you got inside.
Well, it was a building with many, many other things in it, you see. So it was like, it was a big office building. There were multiple companies in there. Anyway, we parked the car and just went in there and asked the staff, like at the desk, where this office might be. And they said they'd never heard of it. They don't know anything about it. And we couldn't see it on any signs or anything like that. It wasn't advertised, but we had done sufficient research at the time to conclude that it definitely was in this building somewhere, you know? So I can't remember. Aaron went and found out somehow. I can't remember how he found out, but he found out that it was on the 13th floor.
Of course.
Of course. Where else was it going to be? 13th floor is not advertised. So all of a sudden we've got this John Malkovich scenario where we're at a floor between floors that doesn't exist, you know. and they're telling us that it doesn't exist and it's not on the list, but we jumped in the elevator and there was a 13 on the elevator, and we got there, and it was completely empty, and it was basically an empty hallway with labels on the doors. So you had each branch of the military had a desk, had an office, you know, so you had Marines and Air Force, Army, Navy. We knocked on a couple of doors, didn't get any answers. And I think we then knocked on the one for the Marines. Somebody opened it. This woman opened it, and she was so startled, like nobody ever knocked on this door. Like, you're not supposed to know this is here. You know, who the hell are you? This kind of, you could, this was what was, yeah, you know, that was clearly what was going on. And, we just said, oh, we're very interested in coming and having a look at these offices, and would you like to do an interview? And you can imagine what the response was, you know. So we were told like, absolutely not, get out of here, you know. And that was that, really. We left. We were not welcome at all. We were given the message pretty clearly that we were not welcome and shouldn't have been there, and it would be best if we left. And considering that we'd already been followed that day by somebody, we don't know who or why, but we called it a day, went home. But that was that's a cool little kind of feather in your cap, you know, if you're, especially someone like me who's quite interested in that stuff, and I mean, I've read David McGowan's book, and then to go and see it for real, all of these locations, and I mean, just the fact that they tried to hide it. You know, it wasn't on the list. It wasn't on the directory. The staff didn't know it was there. It was, you know, it was pretty, pretty like out of Hollywood, you know, like something out of a movie. Yeah.
That's funny. Now, when you, the interview that I referenced was you and Aaron Franz talking with, I'm sorry, I think his name might have been David, but I'm blanking on, do you remember that you were talking?
I think you might have been talking about Tom Secker.
Oh, that's it, Tom Secker. Okay, so Tom...
I think he helped in this, by the way. In fact, from memory, I think he helped us find the location. I'm not sure.
Well, that's what... The reason why that popped into my head is because I think it would have been after your trip to Hollywood... Tom Secker actually co-wrote a book about the Pentagon's involvement in the Hollywood film industry.
Right. That's right. Yeah, I do remember that now.
I don't remember the name of the book, but it would have been after your trip, so.
Yeah, we talked to him. I mean, yeah, we were, I used to be, we used to talk to Tom all the time. We were friends for years, and we had did tons of podcasts, and he was a really good researcher. But it's been a long time since I've spoken to him. So, yeah. But I'm pretty sure he helped out on that trip in terms of just giving us some pointers, because he was really good at digging around. So,
interesting. Yeah. And you have not kept up with Aaron though.
No, I do. I do. We keep in touch, actually.
Oh, great.
It's just that, since I moved to Germany, the time difference, between, me over here and him in LA, I mean, we both got families, you know, and it's very, very difficult to line up a time to do podcasts. Plus, the last 4 or 5 years, there's no movies to talk about, because it was a movie podcast. It was called Themes and Memes, and it was a movie review where we look at all the themes and what messages are being pushed, and you know, these types of connections with the Pentagon and all that, the culture industry, you know, and as we know, since COVID, or even shortly before then, is the number of movies that are worth even seeing is just like nothing. As you said once, kind of recently, they're wrapping it up. So, yeah.
They're tired of entertaining us.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's good. It's that whole thing's moving into the next generation. We're in touch, and we're still trying to do another episode, actually hoping to do one recently, or soon at least. It's just finding the time. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But that's that story.
Well, that's
it. Which was a bit of fun. Yeah.
I think the last third you had said, let's talk about green, sustainable, electric vehicles, etc.
There's something going on with all of that. There's weird experiences, and there's little counterpoints and points of connection between them, and I've just been thinking a lot about it lately. And I think the first thing that came to mind is that we've been here, and I mentioned this to you the other day, we've been getting these stories about solar storms, sun and sunspots, and what do you call them, the solar flares, mm-hmm. right? That was a big topic like a couple of weeks ago. And apparently, and you know, that we saw these auroras around the planet in places where you don't normally see them. Some pretty significant disruption in communications. I mean, I had noticed that personally myself, that a lot of websites were down, internet was not working. I even had a strange sensation a couple of weeks ago where I felt like some kind of outside force was working on me.
Really?
And I can't, yeah, that was scary. It was pretty uncomfortable. I don't know whether it was just me.
Do you
stress
feel like,
and lack of sleep? Or,
do you feel like talking about that a little bit? What the sensation?
Yeah, I was just, it was like, it's hard to describe. It was like a buzzing or something. It was like a frequency, you know, mm-hmm. It was like, it wasn't a sound, but it was tension in the body, tension in the head. I was so, so irritable. I was really, really angry for no reason, you know? Mm-hmm. And I had to sort of just lie there and grin and bear it and breathe through it. And it could just be one of these things that happens sometimes, you know, stress, life, lack of sleep, you know, these can all be factors. But, this is the first time I think I really felt like this feels a bit like it's something happening outside of me. Mm-hmm. So, and then of course we have this scenario here where there's this big story about solar storms, and everybody, well, not everybody, but a lot of people are now sort of talking about this whole idea of a pole shift and all these topics which are kind of like a bit new age and a bit out there, at least for the past 10 years or so, sort of coming back in. The funniest thing, Melissa, that happened when they started talking about solar flares and about all these auroras and stuff, what happened here in Germany?
No.
The chemtrails stopped. They stopped. Like on a dime.
Wow. Have they started back up?
Nope.
Oh, that is really interesting.
That has really got my attention.
Yeah.
Because we have had 3 or 4 days a week spraying. This is on it, and it's hard to say when it's cloudy. It's obviously hard to say what's happening above the clouds, but I would say on average, somewhere between 3 and 4 days, something like 3 and 4 days, 3 or 4 days a week for years. Mm-hmm. You know, it is the norm rather than the exception. The norm is heavy spraying, or at least it has been for the past, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. And it seems that overnight we return to a normal weather pattern. We have had absolutely spectacular weather. Like, I've never seen weather like this in Germany ever. I've been here for 7 years, and this is like we had cloudless skies. And when I say cloudless, I mean not one single cloud for days and days on end.
And real blue skies.
And real blue sky.
Wow, that
real blue.
Adam, you should be documenting this, taking pictures and videos, because no one will ever believe you.
You know what? You're right. I should. I've been talking to people. I've been talking to anybody who will listen about the sudden change in weather and the, have you noticed? You know, most people shrug their shoulders and go, well, it's nice that we get some nice weather.
Yeah.
Well, it is nice actually. And, I've been pining for weather like this for a long time because we had nothing but rain and clouds and wind and storms for about a year. Mm. And then it just stopped.
I actually remember looking for some dark, weird images for the last talk that we did because you were talking about this kind of intense storms and, you know, incredible winds. And I think it was you that mentioned that one day the wind just came from everywhere all at once.
yeah, that's right. We had that. I saw last year storms where, I mean, this can happen in those big supercell type storms that you guys get in the Midwest, especially, you know, mm-hmm. Where the thing that'll rotate. But this was like storms. I've seen a storm tracking down a field, stop, and then track back in the opposite direction. You know, and it's, wow. It's pretty extreme. As I said, it was like that for a long time, and then it just stopped. It just stopped. We had a couple, there was a couple of days where I saw very, very minor spraying, as in like three trails in the morning, and that's it, nothing more. Mm-hmm. You know, do the three little stripes, and then that's it for the whole day. And nothing for the next 2 days. The pattern at the moment seems to be about 4 or 5 days of clear skies and, you know, blue skies, fresh air, natural kind of wind as well, if not stale. Then you'll get maybe a day or two of rain. We had torrential rain out of nowhere on Saturday. We were driving back from down the coast, and it just happened out of nowhere, like sort of traveling at about 60 miles an hour, and had to suddenly slow down to about 30, you know, or 25, just because the rain was so heavy. And then as quickly as it had started, it stopped. And even that was, this is not normal. This is not the sort of weather you see all the time. I don't know what all of this means, but this whole story with the solar flares, my gut is telling me that they're raising awareness, as Alan might have said, mm-hmm. to a new concept. They're establishing something new here. This is going to be a new component in the whole greening agenda. And I think they're going to come out with a geoengineering. My gut tells me that they're going to basically make some kind of admission and go public with it in some way.
I think you're right. You know, the Redux that I put up on Sunday, Alan was talking to the host about chemtrails and the geoengineering. And he said, now in Europe, they have already announced that they're doing this. This was June of 2007. So I was looking around. I did a specific, you know, a targeted search for that, and I couldn't find European publications talking about it. But what I did find was between the autumn of 2006 and you know, like May of 2007.
That was the one that just went up, right? Because I was listening before, and they were talking about this. They were talking about, Alan was saying, yeah, they're going to have to come clean with the spraying or address it in some way.
Yes, yeah. He was saying that they already had in parts of Europe. So I couldn't find that specific documentation, but I actually found what to me was admission. There was one publication, it might have been Nature magazine, saying we're going to have to do this. And then another one saying, is geoengineering the only way to save the planet at this point?
Oh, yeah.
And there have been these kind of trial balloons from time to time, but I do think that you're right, that they keep floating the trial balloons, but at some point they're going to say that, you know, we have to do this, and we have to do it worldwide. And go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, what we saw this article in the mainstream, I think a week or two ago, where they had an incredible sudden downpour in Dubai. They had flooding, like flash floods in Dubai. And this is a place that's in the middle of the desert. It doesn't rain there ever, you know, they were getting flooding, like the planes couldn't take off because there was so much water. And this was in the mainstream, in the BBC News and CNN and all the big ones. They were talking about how this could have potentially been the result of a geoengineering program gone wrong. Mm. So that was right out there. Mm-hmm. You know, it was all, of course, it was done in the typical way where, it, you know, it might be, it might not be. And, you know, they sort of do that sort of surrealistic, it's real but it isn't kind of job on the public on that one. And I think they could also be doing that. It's possible, because this is what they do with a lot of the most controversial, like, concepts and topics, is that you'll have one kind of major news outlet, making it look credible and addressing it, while the other is ignoring it and ridiculing it. So right. They're sort of admitting it, but they're not. And what it does is it just creates unreality. It creates confusion. So it takes the tension out of it. what it gets people to not care and to give up and to forget about it. I think that's what they could be doing that as well. It's a possibility.
I think so. And that is a strategy. That's a technique, because when they want people to think the same thing or react in the same way, then all of the papers in unison say it's this way. This is what's happening.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So if they want to create confusion and to shield or veil the true impact and consequences of what's really going on here, then yeah, they'll do the it's real but it's not. Mm-hmm. It is but it isn't. And that, they'll just keep doing that for a while until most people will just be like, I don't know what to think and I don't care anymore. So you can go ahead and do what the hell you like. Mm-hmm. You know, just leave me alone. I mean, this was even, yeah, we saw a little bit of that with the COVID vaccines as well. There's a little bit of that too, you know, like, well, let's not go down that rabbit hole, but I'm sure people will know what I'm talking about there.
You know, back in the day when people would talk about journalism and what a piece of journalism was supposed to do, you know, it's who, what, why, where, when.
Yeah, exactly.
And you don't present a story until the journalist is ready to ask the question who, what, why, where, when, and answer those questions. And right, now everything is speculative. It's possible. It could be. Experts say, you know, you're not really given any of the basic W's anymore in a story. And I think that is, obviously to create confusion.
Oh, look, absolutely. They will be creating confusion for some people and aggravating others, but the main thing here is destruction of any kind of consensus where people can say, like, well, we understand what's happening here and here's how we feel about it and we don't like it and we may perhaps want it to stop. Yeah. This is what obviously is the goal, is to destroy that. So
I think that the whole electric vehicle story is part of that, because if you think about it, we've been told you have to have an electric vehicle. We're going this way. The UK's come out and said no more gas burning vehicles after, what is it, 2030, I think. We're not going to do that. They've made similar declarations in some states, possibly California in the US. Biden recently announced that he wants a more dedicated approach to meeting those targets. But then the same mainstream will say, well, nobody's buying these EVs, and the different companies have said, we're not making so many, we can't sell what we have now. The charging stations are a joke, you know, as far as where they're dispersed. Then you've got also in the mainstream these articles being released that tell you just how these EVs are not green and they're not sustainable, mm-hmm. because this is how much diesel it takes. This is how much, this is the destruction they do to the environment to go down and mine the minerals that they need to make the batteries, and how long the batteries last, or I should say how short their life is. So I think this is deliberate. And I think the reason why is fatigue, but also I don't think that this was ever the plan.
It was never the plan. This is a transition strategy only, mm-hmm. to end public vehicle ownership.
Yes, yes.
And the people basically, I mean, here in Germany, you've got masses of Teslas coming on the road now. They must have gone down in price, or I don't know, or it's subsidized or something. But this is kind of your new, if you're a good German citizen and you're nice, sort of upper middle class person, then you can buy your Tesla and you get to feel good and you get your subsidy from the government, and it's kind of a status symbol, you know. But of course, I do a lot of traveling, and what I will tell you is that when I'm on the Autobahn here in Germany, I'm constantly seeing these big black burn marks on the side of the road.
Oh no.
And they're turning up everywhere. So And it is also not uncommon to hear stories on the traffic reports about, yeah, there's a burning vehicle blocking the road here. You know, so there's got a lot of burning vehicles in Germany. I'll tell you those for free. Look, I really think this is, it's a con. It was never about any kind of a long-term solution. It's about changing the ownership model. Mm-hmm. It's a transition tool to get people out of private vehicle ownership and into communal vehicle. Basically the community owns the car.
Right.
And we've already got that here, even in my neighborhood. Most people, well, not most, but a significant portion of people here in my apartment building, people that we know in the area in their 30s and 40s, do not own their own cars. They are renting. They have a community car share service, often with electric vehicles. And to them, this is the socially responsible, morally righteous thing to do. So that has been, I mean, it's, we're well on our way.
Successful. Yeah. It's been successful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We rented a van a couple of weeks ago to do a big, long transporting trip. A long drive, about a 700-kilometer round trip. I don't know what that is in miles, so 400 or 500 miles, something like that. Big road trip, you know, and going down, this is a brand new, it's a diesel, so it's not an electric car, but because it's brand new, it's filled with all this electronic assistance and the things run by a damn computer. And I'm going down the Autobahn doing about 130K, just cruising. And all of a sudden I start losing power for no reason. I have to pull over and we have to get a mechanic out there and he can't figure out what's wrong because it's a computer error. The computer has detected a problem and it has put the car into safe mode so that it will only drive slowly. It's, you know, been rendered useless to us. And, you know, I'm not like a mechanic or anything, but, you know, I can change a tire and I can change a spark plug if necessary, but I have to know what's wrong. But you see, all of these new cars have taken you, the driver, out of the picture completely.
Mm-hmm.
You can't repair it now because everything will be fine and then it'll just go into safe mode or switch itself off or what have you. And I've had this experience a couple of times where the computer takes over out of the blue for nothing and it won't tell you why.
Mm-hmm.
So you've just lost your self-sufficiency, your independence, you know? Yeah, the roadside mechanic said that there was no chance that he could do anything. It would have to go to a garage and then they would have to get special technology, plug it into a computer just for that vehicle to find out what the problem is.
What did you do?
Yeah, we had no choice. The guy had to, the roadside mechanic had to tow a big tow truck. So we towed it to the nearest town, took it to a garage. This was Friday night, so they were closing up and they weren't going to deal with it. We ended up getting stranded in the middle of nowhere because the car rental company wouldn't address the problem. They just sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, we'll get back to you. And we ended up having to go and stay at a hotel and waited 24 hours for another car to be delivered. And by which time we'd run out of time and had to drive back home. And again, this is dealing with companies now. I've had this experience a few times with ongoing problems in the last few months, trying to get hold of sort of Europe-wide companies for various things that it was a freight company I'll be dealing with, car rental places we've been dealing with, various other people. You can't get through on anybody anymore because all the companies have split themselves up across different countries in Europe to take advantage of different commerce laws so that they don't actually have to be responsible for anything. So you can't get through to anybody. You can't get any problems solved. Nobody knows what's going on. Nobody calls you back. No one cares. They're probably all working from home these days anyway. That seems to be the standard way. That's the way it's all going now. Customer service, as we used to think about it, seems to be pretty much over. Yeah, well, that was pretty unbelievable. It's one of the worst customer service experiences I've ever had. We are very glad that we have got a car which is a diesel and it doesn't have any fancy electronics in it. And it's got high mileage, but I'm just going to keep pumping time and money into it to keep it running.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm not buying a new model.
Yeah, I'm driving my late father's 18-year-old car, and the last month or so, I don't know if this is transmission or steering column or what, but you know how sometimes it's the first sign of a problem when you have a difficult time getting the car to go into gear?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I have to have my foot all the way down on the brake, I mean, pumped all the way down in there before I can get it. And even then, just kind of before I can get it to go into reverse. And I don't want to contribute to the problem, so I'm not yanking on it or rocking it back and forth or anything. But I kind of go, I don't want to take it and have it looked at, because isn't that one of the first signs of a transmission going when you have a problem like that? I don't know. Maybe I should just bite the bullet and have it looked at. But
yeah, is it? You're saying it's in? This is an automatic or a manual? Sorry, I didn't catch that.
Well, it's an automatic. Yeah.
Yeah. But going into reverse, you have to.
Typically, it's just going into reverse. I haven't noticed it so much putting it into drive, but going into reverse is a real. Slippy. It's just like the gears slippy, and I have to, you know, I have to be alert and go, okay, I'm getting in the car now. I want to back up. So that means I've got to put the foot all the way down on the brake and then carefully bring the gear toward me and then drop it down into reverse, because otherwise I'm going to be fighting it.
Right. Okay.
Before it does it.
Yeah, I don't know what that could be.
Well, anyway, we don't have to fix my car. No. We were just trying to fix my computer earlier today, so the internet.
Yeah.
But what I was saying is that it seems to me that since this car doesn't have a lot of fancy, too many fancy electronics, it's worth trying to keep it maintained. What's my alternative? You know, community shared EV.
Yeah. Well, I mean, over here, you've got the community shared cars and the generation below that, the kids, the students here. So basically like 16 to 25, they just have the scooters, the electric scooters. I'm sure you've seen those things.
Oh, yeah.
This is another one of those things that appeared during lockdowns. We went into the first lockdown in March, April 2020. Everybody came out of their houses 6 weeks later, and all of a sudden, we've got electric scooters everywhere. They just appeared as if overnight, you know? And yeah, it's like
invasion of the body snatchers. What else could it be?
I just, you know, you look at stuff like that, and I mean, you really do. I think of Klaus Schwab at the World Economic Forum saying, you will own nothing and be happy, you know? So... I mean, the kids have taken to that. They all use those things now.
Yeah.
That's standard. They're everywhere. There's hundreds. I mean, there's dozens on our street alone. I've rented one time out of pure necessity, and I'm ashamed of it. But man, the thing barely does 10 kilometers an hour. So, and if you've got a headwind, forget about it. Really. So yeah. But that's it. That's the new model, and the electric cars are basically just a slightly more luxurious version of that. You know, that's all they are, and they are not meant to last. They are not meant to be affordable. They are not meant to replace, you know, normal combustion engine cars. And when I see that if they're being presented as the replacement, then one possible scenario there is that it's going to be a significantly reduced population in the very near future. That could be a part of it as well. I don't know, but it's certainly never intended to be an actual replacement. That much is obvious.
Well, I think we've had three good stories today.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, it was fun.
I'm
glad
we
got to do it. That I was just so disappointed to have the internet go down last night, and then, you know, trying and thinking, I thought, oh, my luck is, you know, I've got this 4-hour window that he'll be here and he'll come on the very tail end. But that was not, I had good luck. So I'm glad we got to do it.
That was good. I mean, we could have made it work another time, but tonight was the best, I think, the best opportunity for me. So I will be busy later on. So it was good, and it's good to, I hope other people listening enjoyed it. It's nothing, nothing fancy, no big theme here, but, it can be nice to have a bit of a rant and just go through some stories knowing that, you've got a like-minded audience, and to talk to you as well. And you know that you appreciate the significance of what I'm talking about, which is, it's not common, put it that way.
Everything that we talked about is real history.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah. Right. That's, we're living through it. It's here.
Yeah. I think the, I'd be interested to see what other people think perhaps of the, of this solar flare story. Because I think something I mentioned to you just in closing was that it reminded me of COVID. The reporting on this has reminded me of COVID, which, because COVID was a slow burner. It didn't happen overnight. They built it up slowly over months. Mm-hmm. It started before Christmas in China, and it took a good 3 months until we went into lockdown. So they built that one up slowly. It was just familiarizing, turning up the heat. Everybody's speculating, oh, it's nothing. Oh, we'll be fine. Oh, no, it's really serious. We have to prevent, but it's all the debate, the usual stuff, drama. And it slowly, slowly, slowly starts becoming part of that reality until we go into full crisis mode. And I'm seeing the same code and the same language in the sunspot story. I saw it at the beginning, and now I'm seeing there continue to be articles on this around the world. And they're saying, oh, these storms are continuing. They could get worse. Mm-hmm. And watch out. So,
I think it's an interesting idea.
Part of the picture.
Yeah, I think you might be onto something there, Adam. Because what I noticed in the first stories that came out around it in some of the major publications like Washington Post and New York Times is that they made sure to plant key words like loss of instrument panels. Disruption of flights and the electronic pulses that, so they were planting these terms that, they're
all
new.
All the stuff that you've seen they're new in the mainstream, but they have been in Hollywood blockbuster films.
Yes,
before.
Exactly.
So people are already familiar with them.
Yeah. But they're putting it into, this could happen. This could happen.
Yeah. It's very interesting, but it's not like a lot of the other dramas out there. This one really piqued my interest, and I feel it's somehow connected. This is going to be a linchpin in this whole scenario with the environmental push. It's connected to the geoengineering, the spraying. This is somehow being introduced as part of that picture, and the justification, the excuse, something for, and I kind of suspect that we are moving in the direction of some kind of revelation in regards to the bigger picture with geoengineering. If only for the fact that we've had such clear weather for so long here that once they start spraying again, people are then, if they don't notice then,
don't no. hold your breath, Adam.
sure, I probably shouldn't. Yeah, I probably shouldn't.
Yeah. All right. Anyway. Well, everybody, I don't have a plan for next week, so stay tuned, and we shall see what happens. And Adam, thank you so much for doing this with me. It was fun.
Not at all. My pleasure, as always. We will no doubt do it again in future, but to anybody else listening, you should step up and fill in the gap if Melissa needs some help.
Good.
For other people.
All right. I expect to have some emails. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. It's not hard. Don't overthink it. Just do it.
All right. Yeah.
Hi, Melissa. Just a quick addendum to the conversation we had a couple of nights ago, because we were talking about the weather and how the spraying had all stopped. Well, I just thought I'd say a quick hi and give you an update, because the very next morning it was back to business as usual. So we went from remarkably clear skies and good weather to straight back into pretty significant spraying. The haze, the air went stale, and then the next morning, so this morning, woke up, and we've got massive, massive thunderstorms rolling in here. The sky has gone from being incredibly clear to black. And I'm not sure if you can hear in the background, but there's some massive thunderstorms coming in. So, yeah, maybe you can post that as an addendum or something, but I just thought it bears mentioning. I think the other reason was because in that Redux that you posted where Alan was talking to the guy on American Awakening, they were talking about the spraying having an impact on people's moods, you know, those sort of potential tranquilizing drugs could have been included in the spraying. And of course, I'm feeling irritable today, and I've just popped into the local town to get some supplies, and everybody's irritable. Something's up. You can smell it, you can feel it, you can taste it. So that's that. But we'll see how it goes. Thanks.
Everybody, just tune in for the mystery show next week. Thank you. Oh,